Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jozerich. Aristotle had a unique seat to view the major historic events of his time and just before his time. As an adult, he lived in ancient Athens during one of the most radical democratic experiments in history. A democratic system he could not participate in because he was an immigrant. His teacher Plato witnessed the execution of his own teacher Socrates, who a democratic court deemed guilty of impiety towards the gods and corrupting the youth. Plato would become one of history's most powerful anti-democrats. His works have been studied ever since, becoming the foundation of the Western philosophical tradition, and they played a key role in suppressing the democratic impulse for the next 2,000 years. And Aristotle's own student, Alexander, would rise to lead the Greek Empire of Macedon, and along with conquering practically the known world, Alexander, once and for all, would extinguish democracy in Athens. Aristotle had some kind of a connection to all of this, a degree of separation. He studied these events closely, and they informed some of the most important political, philosophical work in history. He came up with a theory about the nature of political power, and how it evolved, and how it decayed. It was a formula that collectively looked at monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, the three forms of government in his day and also in ours. And it went like this. He starts with monarchy, that early on has a benevolent king who cares about the welfare of his subjects. But like most monarchies, it devolves, usually once the children come to power, and decays into tyranny. This becomes so unbearable that the next most powerful sector of society, the wealthy elite, rise up, overthrows the monarchy, and installs itself in an aristocracy. The old Greek word aristocracy meant of the best, the most qualified, and this too works for a short period of time, but it also devolves, once again usually after the children take over, and decays into oligarchy, which in the old Greek word meant rule by the wealthy, who would use that power to further enrich themselves. Well, this too becomes unbearable, and as time goes by, the people rise up, and they overthrow the aristocracy turned oligarchy and install a democracy. The word democracy is a compound of two old Greek words, demos, meaning the people, and kratos, meaning power. The people have the power. This too works well at first, as people are in the civic spirit, but it also decays and turns into what was called ochlocracy, which meant rule by the mob. It creates factionalism, instability, and civic strife. And this too becomes unbearable, that the stage is once again set for the return of a strong-armed king or dictator who is able to stop the chaos and bring a sense of normalcy back to life. And hence, the cycle begins all over again. I had found this formula to be instructive in understanding political power and rule. It doesn't mean every situation fits into this paradigm. The truth is, rarely does it even go in this order of monarchy, aristocracy, democracy. Oftentimes it's a mix of that. But it does go to show how these three forms of rule that have dominated civilization for as long as we know is never static. It evolves. It has its high marks, and it has its lows. For the next 3 days, we are changing the format of this program. I myself will be bringing you the story of the oldest fully formed democracy that we have on record. I am talking about ancient Athens more than 2,500 years ago, in which the people over the next two centuries of that time rejected oligarchic and tyrannical rule and put the power directly into their own hands. It's a remarkable story in which, for a rare moment in history, the masses had power. I begin today with what I like to call democracy's creation story, a story that revolves around a homosexual love triangle, terrorism, and the assassination of a tyrant. Tomorrow, the story of how democracy, through the decades, was born out of class struggle, and how inequality and debt slavery was at the core of it. And on Thursday, the excesses of Athenian democracy, including the growth of a militaristic empire, mass murder, and the legal and democratic execution of the Western world's most famous philosopher, Socrates. I want to be clear that I am not a specialist on this history. I am not a historian nor a classicist. I am a trained journalist, and I am using multiple resources and accounts and bringing them together to tell what I hope will be a good story, a story that's educational and provides a deeper understanding of democracy itself. Democracy is old. It's older than the United States. It's older than the Enlightenment, where ideas of democracy resurfaced 300 years ago after going dormant for almost 2,000 years. It's older than Christianity and the Roman Empire. Some say it's as old as the human race itself, that democracy is not a political theory needing to be invented, but something intuitively understood by people all over the world, that a majority decides for the whole, and that has been performed all over the world ever since time immemorial. And there's something that feels right about that. The oldest and fullest account we have of a developed democratic system comes from ancient Athens. This is also a time and place that was considered to be the beginning of Western civilization, though that's always up for debate. But before this beginning, there was another important reality. Athens was part of an interconnected Mediterranean world in which ideas flowed from one side of the sea to the other, including from Persia and Egypt. Athens had more in common with the Middle East and North Africa than, say, to the rest of Western Europe. Consider the first historian, Herodotus, gave us this notion of Western and Eastern world, claimed that Egypt, at this time already an ancient civilization itself, brought great influence to the Greek world, especially when it came to religion. I want to begin here with a story. It's democracy's creation story. Even though you'll hear over the next few days, it's actually smack dab in the middle of the story that will unfold on the history of democracy. But the story is called The Tyrannicides, The Killers of the Tyrants. The year was 514 BCE. Athens was ruled by two brothers, Hippias and Hipparchus. Hippias was known as the tyrant, and his brother Hipparchus was next in line. Tyrant is an ancient Greek word that means a ruler who seized power without the legal right to it. To seize power illegitimately, different to our use today of tyrant, meaning cruel and oppressive ruler. In ancient Greece, you could have a largely good tyrant or a benevolent tyrant, just like we use the term today, a benevolent dictator. Benevolent, that is, as long as you are not on the opposite side of a political struggle. But benevolent meaning an absolute ruler who used that absolute power to serve the people. The brothers came to power after the death of their father, Pisistratus, also a tyrant, who overthrew the long-standing aristocratic elite that ruled Athens before. For much of the previous 100 years, Athens was ruled by a small circle of land-owning elites who served in a set of political institutions that they could only serve in. Over the next 100 years, some of these same institutions would be opened up to the masses, including to the poor. It's not democracy yet, but it will be. The aristocratic rule, by this time turned oligarchic, produced extreme inequality, and this inequality led to social unrest. And that unrest was then channeled through a single leader or a demagogue, Pisistratus, who used that unrest to overthrow the oligarchs and then installed himself as tyrant. Pisistratus, unlike his sons to follow, was seen as this benevolent tyrant who owed his rise to power to the poor masses. But he was also a keen politician, and he allowed the wealthy and powerful who accepted his rule to remain in these aristocratic political bodies, which he downgraded to be just an advisory role. But you could still serve in them and advise the tyrant. You just didn't have the power anymore. The oligarchs who accepted Pisistratus' rule still had good standing. But those who did not accept his rule, well, they went into exile. And tomorrow you'll hear about how one of those who went into exile would become, quote-unquote, a traitor to his class and forever be remembered as the founder of democracy. But of course, Pisistratus had a debt to pay to the poor, and he was good on it. making great cause with the common people, which is not unheard of for a dictator or a king to side with the masses against the aristocracy, because the aristocracy usually proved a greater threat to a dictator's rule. Pisistratus provided loans for small farmers. In some cases, he redistributed land from the large estate owners to the poor, probably the land of those who opposed his rule and went into exile. He invested in public work projects, and he helped grow what was called the Panathenaic Games, which became an important cultural event and important to the story to come. The Panathenaic Games was something akin to, say, combining the Olympics, Christmas, and a grand theater festival all into one major religious event that spanned several days. But alas, even a good tyrant or king or dictator eventually dies and is replaced by the children, who are rarely as capable of ruling. And this starts the cycle in which the children inevitably lose the love of their people, their credibility is tarnished, and then, to maintain power, they're forced to rule with an iron fist and through fear. After Pisistratus died, his son Hippias took over as tyrant, and his brother Hipparchus assisted him and remained in line to take over if anything happened to Hippias. While Hippias was busy running the city-state of Athens and not doing a bad job at it, mostly keeping the course set by his father, his brother Hipparchus gained a reputation for having a decadent lifestyle and for abusing his power. And this becomes apparent and will be remembered in history with his amorous desire for a man by the name of Harmodius. But there was a problem. Harmodius, who came from a well-respected aristocratic family himself, was already in a relationship with a different man by the name of Aristogeiton, and he had no interest in pursuing another affair with a tyrant's brother. So he did what a lot of people do, at least used to do, when a more powerful person advances upon them. He ignored him, and he hoped it would just all go away. Afterwards, Harmodius told his lover Aristogeiton about it, and Aristogeiton feared that Hipparchus, the brother of the tyrant, would respond with violence. For who dares reject the advances of such a powerful man? So Aristogeiton begins to chart a plan, just in case if Hipparchus responds punitively. Now, are these guys gay? I think so, at least the very, very least bisexual. But that's me giving a 21st century definition to a relationship that existed over 2,500 years ago. And I think it's fair to say people probably saw things differently, defined things differently than we would today. It was normal for men, or even a man and a teenage boy in Athens 2,500 years ago, or even throughout all of Greece, to be in a sexual relationship with each other while also being married to a woman and having a family. So back to the story. Hipparchus, the brother to the tyrant, had enough sense to know that using violence to respond to Harmodius rebuffing his amorous overtures was political risky. Again, things were still running smoothly in Athens, and the people had a relatively positive view towards his brother Hippias, the tyrant, as they still fondly remembered the rule of the father, Pisistratus. Now, that doesn't mean Harmodius's rejection was received well, because it was not. And Hipparchus is a man of great privilege who is accustomed to getting what Hipparchus wants. And who is Hipparchus to be denied? So a conniving Hipparchus devised a plan to bring great shame to the family of Harmodius. This is an age when a family's reputation was everything. It was like currency. A family with good reputation would be afforded many opportunities and privileges in the ancient world. And of course, it was quite the opposite for a family with a bad reputation. Hipparchus's plan to bring shame to Harmodius's family would be carried out at the upcoming Panathenaic Games, again, this mammoth cultural, religious, and sporting event. In what seemed to be a great honor to Harmodius's family, Hipparchus gave Harmodius's young sister, probably in her early teens, the role of carrying the ceremonial basket at the opening of the games, Again, under normal circumstances, this would be a great honor. But these were not normal circumstances. As the opening ceremony began, and as Harmodius's sister walked through with the ceremonial basket in hand, Hipparchus, brother to the tyrant, leapt to his feet, grabbed the basket from her hands, and yelled at the top of his lungs that this girl had not been invited to carry the ceremonial basket because she was not a virgin, and only a virgin could perform such an honored role. The patriarchy is strong in ancient Athens, and women had no political rights whatsoever, nor would they gain them when democracy would come to the land. This accusation, brought by the next in line to the throne, devastated the family of Harmodius. The accusation was probably a lie, but what to do when the second most powerful man in Athens makes it? Harmodius left the games, and he found his lover Aristogiton to tell him what had happened. Aristogiton went into a lover's rage, and in that rage finalized his own plan for revenge. He, Harmodius, and a small cadre of conspirators would assassinate not one, but both the brothers, both Hipparchus and the tyrant Hippias. The attack was planned to occur at the Panathenaic Games on the only day that the people were allowed to bring their own weapons as part of the ceremony. And while the group of assassins was small, they hoped once the attack began, the armed crowd would rise up and join them in overthrowing the tyranny. The day arrived, and the lovers Harmodius and Aristogiton, armed with their daggers, entered the festival grounds, and immediately saw one of their own co-conspirators who, unbelievably, was talking to Hipparchus, the target of their assassination, and the brother to the tyrant. Fearing the plot was revealed, the lovers jumped into action and rushed with daggers in hand at Hipparchus, and upon reaching him at the foot of the Acropolis, they tackled Hipparchus, and they stabbed him again and again in a fervor that only revenge could bring. Hipparchus, brother to the tyrant, was dead. Hipparchus's guards, surprised by the attack, were slow to stop the assassination. But recovering quickly, they thrusted their spears into the body of Harmodius, killing him on the spot. So now the tyrant's brother, Hipparchus, and the object of Hipparchus's desire, Harmodius, were both dead. If only Shakespeare, who frequently retold the tragedies of ancient Greek stories, had written about this one. But he didn't. So we're doing it here instead. Rather than spark the uprising that the lovers had hoped for, the attack sent the crowd at the games into a frenzy, and the chaos allowed for Aristogiton to escape, but only temporarily. A short time later, Aristogiton was captured by the guards, but he was not killed. No, they took him alive. They tortured him, and they interrogated him, trying to find out who the other conspirators were. Aristogiton said he'd give the names of the others, but only if the tyrant himself, the brother of the slain Hipparchus, gave him his hand in a gesture, ensuring Aristogiton's safety afterwards. So Hippias, the tyrant, who was already there participating in the interrogation, offered his hand to Aristogiton. And Aristogiton grabbed the hand of Hippias. He clutched it firmly, and then began to boldly yell at the tyrant, "How dare he hold the hand of the man who killed his brother?" These shocking words caused Hippias to go into a rage. Veins bulging from his head and from his neck, Hippias wrestled his hand free. He stepped back, he grabbed a sword, and he struck Aristogiton to death. The story does not end here, for how could this be democracy's creation story if it did? The aftermath of this act of terror in killing Hipparchus, the brother of the tyrant Hippias, made Hippias sick in the head, and made him deeply paranoid of a larger plot to overthrow his reign. He ruled for the next 3 years in a way that you could say would give the word tyranny its modern definition of extreme cruelty. He executed those he suspected being part of the conspiracy without trial. He enacted security measures greatly inconveniencing the masses, and he arrested those he suspected without evidence, who he thought knew more about the conspiracy. He tightened the reins to the point where the people who once loved the father, Pisistratus, the tyrant, began to hate the son, Hippias. So the conditions were right for the aristocrats and their descendants who did not accept the rule of Pisistratus and who went into exile to conspire with the outside military force of Sparta, the great military rival to Athens, and to drive out Hippias because Hippias had lost the support of the masses. Sparta, a military dictatorship itself, though with its own complex governing structure, returned power to the elites who were favorable to itself. Inevitably, this set in motion a long series of events as people would reject the return of the oligarchs and a struggle would give rise to democracy itself. And that's a story that I will be giving you tomorrow. Democracy's creation story is instructive in thinking about the politics of terrorism and its role in the creation of Athenian democracy. There is a shocking act of terrorism with the assassination of the tyrant's brother. The ruling regime sees the act of terrorism as a threat to itself, so it overreacts in a ruthless, draconian way to stamp it out that inevitably and negatively affects all of the citizens who weren't even involved in the act of terrorism itself. This makes life under the regime unbearable, and soon enough the people turn against it, and what started off as terrorism by some hardliners would turn into a popular resistance. We see this not just in ancient Athens, but through all of history, including today. It's brilliantly depicted in the 1966 film The Battle of Algiers, about the 1954 Algerian War for Independence against French colonialism. A woman, actually several women, with bombs in their bags, enters a bar or a cafe or a restaurant. They leave the bags there. The bomb goes off, killing many people. Everyone is terrified by it. Everyone, regardless of who they are. But then the ruling colonists overreact in trying to stamp out the opposition to its rule. It clamps down on the populace, and sure enough, the people, who also earnestly desire self-rule, are mobilized into a mass movement for independence. Harmodius and Aristogiton committed a shocking act of terrorism by assassinating the tyrant's brother at the Panathenaic Games. But it was more of a lover's revenge, actually, rather than of some lofty political ideas. The immediate armed uprising that they had hoped for had never transpired immediately, at least not immediately. It was the tyrant's paranoia over the threat to his regime that caused so much suffering to the people, and that, in the end, was its undoing. In the decades to come, the poor masses of Athens, who struggled for the right to participate in governing themselves, drew their inspiration from this story, the legend of Harmodius and Aristogiton. It was a story they told themselves about the beginning of democracy. The slaying of the tyrant's brother ended up being that spark that was needed for a movement that would just come a few short years later. Harmodius and Aristogiton became so revered that once democracy took hold in ancient Athens, Athenians, led by the man named Cleisthenes, who instituted the democratic reforms in the years ahead, placed a statue of both of these lovers in the center of the Agora, which is at the very center of the city, sort of the center of religious and civic life, and no other statues other than these two lovers were allowed to be erected within a certain distance of these. And the statues were engraved with this, quote, "A marvelous light shone upon Athens when Aristogiton and Harmodius slew Hipparchus, and they would forever be known as the tyrannicides, the killers of the tyrant." And that, my friends, is the story, Tyrannicides, Democracy's Creation Story. And you are listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Again, over these next 3 days, including today, we are breaking out of our regular format to give you a telling of the oldest democracy that we have a full accounting of. In a moment, I will tell you a couple of stories about other examples of democracy outside of Athens, including a debate within the Persian Empire. And this would actually occur before democracy came to Athens. So again, when we say frequently it is said that democracy was born in Athens, I try not to say that because, as I pointed out earlier, there's an argument that democracy is not something that needed to be invented, but is something that is inherently understood by people all over the world, that if you have a group of people, a majority of that group decides what that group is going to do. And that sounds reasonable to me. We also have evidence of democracy, especially in the Greek world, occurring before it is instituted in Athens, but we don't have a great account of it. It's just sort of fragments here and there. It is Athens where we get with the evidence that we have, the information that we have, that we see the first fully formed democratic system. But as history goes, especially when we talk about ancient history, it does not mean it was necessarily the first or that it was born there. These are all contentious issues that are being debated amongst historians. Tomorrow, we're going to get into the details of how democracy was born out of a class struggle between the landed aristocracy and the poor masses. And on Thursday, we'll talk about Athenian democracy, how it transformed itself into a militaristic empire, became a settler colonial state, and that would take over other lands, and then also how it led to the execution of Socrates through the democratic process. This is part of our Spring 2023 Fund Drive, and I have always felt when I'm asking you for something special, which is your financial support, I should be doing something special in return. If you want to help us with this endeavor, I ask you to make a contribution that you can afford. One is according to your means, and one that you feel good about going upon your day, knowing that you did your part. I do want to let you know that we have a challenge that has come in, and we're seeking challenges. We have a special next week as well. I will hold off until later this week to tell you about that. But again, we're trying something special these last 2 weeks of a very important spring fund drive, hoping rather than turn you off, which I have to acknowledge is also a possibility, hoping that it might also inspire you to support this endeavor, because, you know, the interesting things that we could try to do on the radio, trying to summing up the past here and do it through, and tell these stories through the good old oral tradition. But we need your support to do it. And so I'm asking for a contribution that you can afford. If you're interested in a thank you gift, we have limited editions. So if you're interested, do this now. Limited editions of I.F. Stone, the great muckraking journalist. The last book he wrote, I'll talk about this a little bit, but the last book he wrote is called The Trial of Socrates, and we are offering that for a pledge of $100. The phone number for our friends listening to KPFA in the San Francisco Bay Area is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. 5732, and online at kpfa.org. And for our friends in Southern California listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the phone number that you're going to call is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. I did reference there a challenge. I should probably tell you about it. Mark in Oakland is putting up $1,200 this hour. It would be very important for us to be able to raise this $1,200. At this moment, we have yet to quite get exactly to our goal. We're averaging below, but again, we're trying to do something special. It's a marathon. So there's $1,200 on the line right now. This could be a big deal, because if we can make this $1,200, that gets us $2,400 for the hour. Getting there gets us within striking distance of making our goal of $3,000 this hour. And if you appreciate this effort that we're trying to do in this fund drive, but telling the story of the oldest, I call it the oldest democracy we have accounting of, now is the time to do it. Help us get there so that we could do these special events. If we make that $1,200, everyone who donates up to that point of $1,200 will have their donation doubled as well. So the phone number for KPFA listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. That's also true for KFCF listeners in the Central Valley. You call the KPFA number or go to the KPFA website. We make sure your donation gets to your radio station. We look at the zip code of where the listener is, where the listeners are. And then for our friends in Southern California listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the number you're going to call is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 and online at kpfk.org. Put a lot of work into this. I used about 15 different books in preparing for the telling of the ancient Athenian democracy. But the one that stands out the most to me, the one that was, again, written by legendary muckraking journalist I.F. Stone. Again, it's called The Trial of Socrates. It is the clearest and lucid of all the books I have read about this history. Be honest, a lot of these books aren't so lucid and clear, real academic books. Not this one. Not I.F. Stone's book, The Trial of Socrates. The book focuses on the trial of the world's greatest Western philosopher, Socrates. It puts the trial in context of how Athens' democratic rule was overthrown twice in a little more than a decade before Socrates himself was tried, and how Socrates and also Plato, who immortalized Socrates, were actually anti-democrats. They opposed rule. And Socrates was even the teacher of those who would try to and did temporarily overthrow democracy. Now, Socrates did not try to overthrow the democracy itself, so we should be clear about that. But he and Plato were very critical of the democratic process, did not think it was the appropriate way to rule. And they taught this, and they ended up being tried for it, and Socrates inevitably was executed before it. It's a complicated story and one that I'll get more into on Thursday. But if you're interested in a thank you gift, again, we're offering this book, which I think is the clearest telling and the most interesting and pleasant reading of the books that there are about this history. It's I.F. Stone's Great Muckraking Journalist, yours for a pledge of $100. The phone number again for KPFA listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is also true for KFCF listeners in the Central Valley, is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, the phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. And online at kpfk.org. Now, it is believed that democracy existed throughout the Greek world. As I was saying, before Athens, there are fragments of evidence that turn up here and there, but no real full accounting of it like the way we see in Athens, as I was saying. However, to get a sense of perhaps how much older democracy is, we do see elements that are fascinating, including elements of it in myth. For example, in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, we see ad hoc formations of sort of small democratic bodies. These Greek myths were believed to have been formulated around 800 BCE and tells of the 10-year Trojan War that may have occurred as far back as 1200 BCE, if it actually occurred at all. And right as the curtain is raised in the Iliad about the Trojan War, there is the formation of an assembly. Just like we have assembly in California. But this is an ad hoc assembly. This is a small group, a body of an assembly basically means a body of people that makes decision. Assembly comes the Greek word ecclesia, and it's to call out. And when you call out for the body to come, then the people come and you make a decision. And in the Iliad, we see this body, we see the assembly override the will of the king. The assembly, again, ecclesia in Old Greek, would end up becoming at the heart of Greek democracy in the years to come. In the Iliad, a priest came to reclaim his daughter that the Greek soldiers kidnapped. The priest served the god Apollo, and the priest promised Apollo's support in the war against Troy if only his daughter was returned. But Agamemnon, who is a boastful and stupid king, was infatuated with the priest's daughter, and he refused to release her. And this is when the problems begin for Agamemnon and his troops, because the king's refusal angered Apollo, and the god sent a plague to the soldiers. Homer described the camp as becoming thick with smoke from the burning pyre of bodies. So Achilles himself, the mass-murdering hero of the Iliad, and also the strongest warrior of them all, calls an assembly of all the soldiers. And a fierce debate ensued, but eventually the group collectively decided that King Agamemnon must return the priest's daughter. Collectively, they overrode the king's power. Agamemnon, against his will, releases the girl, and then the plague was lifted. So again, that's just one. There's several other examples, both in the Iliad and Odyssey, of this assembly coming together. It's where we get our own term, assembly, that we find in the California state legislature. We also have accounts of democracy being debated outside of not just Athens in the Greek world, but in Persia, in the Middle East. Herodotus gave us the story of the rise of Darius the Great, before he was actually considered great, to the throne of Persia. And it's a most fascinating story in which you will hear in this debate that I'm going to tell you about this model, this formula that Aristotle laid out about the forms of government and how they evolve and decay from monarchy to aristocracy to democracy. You'll hear this long before Aristotle. Maybe even Aristotle took some of his influence from this story about how Persia would be ruled. So Darius came to power after he and a group of six other men, they were collectively known as the Seven, overthrew the Magi, who previously usurped power from the Persian king Cambyses the Mad, son of Cyrus the Great, who was the founder of the Persian Empire. After throwing these usurpers and 3, 2, 1. After overthrowing these usurpers and beheading them, three of the so-called Seven began a debate on what kind of rule should govern Persia, monarchy, oligarchy, or democracy. The first to speak was a man by the name of Otanes, and he spoke in favor of democracy. "In my opinion," he said, "we should forget the idea of installing one man as leader. We have seen how Cambyses, son of Cyrus the Great, went mad and abused his power. How can a monarch create order when he could do as much as he pleases and not be held accountable? Even the best of men are corruptible. A monarch manipulates tradition, rapes women, and executes men without trial." "Rule by the majority," Otanes continued, "is the fairest of all, as it bears equality before the law. Those who rise to power do so by lottery, and they are held to account. This is why I argue we abolish the monarchy in favor of the rule by the masses." And thus finished Otanes, and he sat back down. Next up was a man by the name of Megabyces, and he argued in favor of oligarchic rule. "There is nothing more lacking than the intelligence of a mob," he said. "How terrible people should escape the brutality of a tyrant only to be ruled by a violent, uncontrollable crowd. Let us instead have the finest men and trust them with governing. We, obviously, will be among them, and it's only natural that the men with the highest rank and best standing will be the most capable and wisest to rule." And thus finished Megabyces, and he sat back down. Lastly, Darius rose to speak, and he spoke in favor of monarchy. "Megabyces is quite right about the illogic of having a mob rule," he said, "but he misleads when he speaks about oligarchy. Even oligarchs wish to be first among peers, and will always look to enrich themselves. The corruption will become so great that inevitably, a single person with the support of the masses will have to step in and put an end to it, and the masses will inevitably call on that person to wear the monarch's robe. So it is monarchy that stands above the others and best serves our land, for who else could lead without favor for one group over another, but wisely decide the best for the whole? Who else can enact the wisest decisions without delay? It is the way of our excellent ancestors who gave birth to our empire, and that is why I support the keeping of monarchy." And thus finished Darius, and he sat back down. After the debate, it was up to the Seven to decide what form of rule would take hold in the Persian Empire. Otanes, recognizing democracy had no chance of prevailing, withdrew his candidacy. The remaining options were Megabysis and oligarchy, or Darius and monarchy. They decided that the best way to choose was to take their horses the next day at sunrise to the outskirts of the city, and whoever horse neighed first after the sun rose from the east would be the winner. Of course, this sounds crazy, but chance was used frequently in the ancient world for important decisions because it was believed to allow the gods to intervene and play their role. But Darius was not going to leave it to chance, so he went to his clever servant, Obares, and said, "Obares, with your unmatched wit, find a way to ensure that I win the kingdom tomorrow." Now, a quick word about Herodotus, who told this story in his book, The Histories. This is where we get the word history. He gives a couple of different endings to this story, like he does many stories. And while they all end up with Darius winning, which is no surprise because Darius will become Darius the Great. But Herodotus tells you right at the beginning of his book, The Histories, that he is giving you the stories that were told to him. And rather than determining which one was true and which one was false, he just gives you all of them and lets you decide. But for this telling that I am doing, I'm just going to give you one version for the sake of time and also hopefully in the sake for a good story. I am going to give you the most outrageous one, even though they're all kind of equally outrageous. But anyways, so Herodotus writes that Obares goes finds himself a mare, and he rubs his hands all over the mare's genitals. And then the next morning, when the men gathered with their horses and the sun began to rise from the east, Obares approached the horse of Darius, took his hand out from his garment, and placed it directly under the nostrils of Darius's horse. The horse got so steam, snorted out loud, and then gave a whopping neigh. And all the other men immediately dismounted their own horses and kneeled before the new king, Darius, soon to be remembered as Darius the Great. Which he was, you could argue. Darius would grow the Persian Empire to become the most powerful of all the Mediterranean world. He was also remembered for his ability to administer the empire, which was no easy feat because it was huge. It spanned from the Mediterranean Sea well into Central Asia. The Persian Empire itself is a fascinating story, and maybe one day we will give.